When energy costs jump, everyone feels it. At the Bowser, on the power bill, and across the economy.
I'm Alan Kohler.
And I'm Carrington Clark. On ABC Business Daily's Fuelcast, we break down the latest in fuel, energy, and the forces driving prices.
It's a quick, clear update on what's moving, why it matters, and what it can mean for your wallet and the wider economy.
Find Fuelcast in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
I naturally turned on the television coverage and it was just extraordinary, and it rocked the country. There's no other way of describing it.
It's been 30 years since the Port Arthur massacre, and it's remembered not just for the horror of that day, but also for the political and societal response that followed. It changed Australia forever. Then Prime Minister John Howard played a really major role in that response. So today on The Wrap, you're going to hear his reflections. Then we'll head to the United States. An ex-FBI agent will take us through what we know about the shooting at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Most of that hotel complex was not under the protection of the Secret Service, and it was open for business as well, and that's how the assailant managed to book a room.
From Radio National Breakfast, this is The Breakfast Wrap. It is the deadliest mass shooting in modern Australian history. Port Arthur, Tasmania, April 28th, 1996. Today, 30 years on, victims and dignitaries are gathering at the historic site to remember the 35 victims shot dead and the 23 others wounded in the violence. But it's not just their memories being reflected upon today. Also, the historic response to the tragedy, led by then Prime Minister John Howard.
John Howard, apparently on the advice of his security staff, took the unprecedented step for a Prime Minister of wearing an anti-shrapnel jacket, the outline visible beneath his coat.
The whole thing smells to me of a stunt to try to arouse public sympathy for the Prime Minister in his stand against shooters.
Right now, we have the biggest public dissent Australia has ever seen with a government decision.
I'm not going to give up any guns that they're going to take off me. Are you going to give yours up?
Get rid of the guns and you stop homicides. Get rid of the guns and you stop robberies. What a load of unadulterated bloody garbage.
Listening to you on the telly, you have said, and so has, Flak Jacket Johnny? Flak Jacket Johnny Howard. You have said that it is a closed shop, that we cannot get those weapons for those legitimate shooters.
Well, we can all dish out offensive language, but I don't think it advances the debate very far. I have been here to listen and to hear. This is where this debate has got right off the rails.
Tim Fischer has displayed more guts on this issue than anybody.
We need to turn away from heading in the direction of the USA, and thank God we're not there yet.
It would be simply unforgivable if, in the wake of Port Arthur, we don't go for uniform, tighter gun laws.
If the political process in Australia turns against me because of the decision that I have taken, I will accept that decision.
And that compilation was put together by Katie McAllister. So this morning on Radio National Breakfast, Sally Sarah spoke with the former Prime Minister, John Howard.
Can I take you back to this time? You got the call at home at Kirribilli House on the afternoon of April the 28th. Was it immediately clear to you how deadly and significant this attack was at Port Arthur?
Not immediately, but it pretty quickly became apparent that it was a tragedy of a special magnitude. And I think I was first alerted to it by my press secretary, Tony O'Leary, and I naturally turned on the television coverage, and it was just extraordinary, and it rocked the country. There's no other way of describing it.
3 days later, you were in Tasmania at the site and met with victims and community members. How challenging was that as a leader, trying to console those who had been directly affected?
Well, I felt immediately that I had to go to Tasmania. And the Premier of Tasmania suggested that I did, and I didn't really need a suggestion, but I was happy to do so and wanted to do so, and I did make a point of ringing Kim Beazley, who was the leader of the Labor Party in the opposition, and also Cheryl Kerner. And I suggested that they should accompany me so we could demonstrate from the beginning that this would be a bipartisan response, that it was about politics. And I'd just been elected to as Prime Minister after a long period in opposition with a huge majority, and I developed a view pretty quickly that I had to do something significant. What's the point of having a big majority unless you're prepared to use it?
Within a week or so, a cabinet had signed off on the landmark firearms agreement, including a buyback scheme worth hundreds of millions of dollars that scrapped around 650,000 weapons. Were you confident then, in the face of some significant opposition, that most Australians were with you on that move?
Well, I was certainly confident that the great majority of Australians supported what we did. But there were pockets of opposition, and there were a lot of people who were farmers and in the regions who took the attitude that they'd always handle their firearms in a responsible way, that they needed them for their work and to run their businesses, and it was a bit unreasonable what we were trying to do. But what I proposed, and I had to get the cooperation of the states, because the only direct constitutional power the federal government had was to control the importation of automatic and semi-automatic weapons, and they were the weapons that we were seeking to prohibit, and we had to get the states. Now, the states were in the main helpful, but there was understandably a lot of concern on our side of politics in some of the National Party seats. And the way in which Tim Fischer, who's no longer with us, and John Anderson, leader and deputy leader of the National Party, and Rob Borvitch, the National Party Premier of Queensland, the way that they cooperated, despite the difficulties they had with some of their own constituency, was quite magnificent. And I frequently said, and I'll say it again this morning, that without their cooperation, it would have been very, very difficult.
One of the enduring images of that time in politics was you attending one rally wearing a bulletproof vest. What lessons did you take?
Well,
from...
there's a history to that. My federal police detail came to me and said that they'd got advice from the Victoria police that somebody had made a very explicit threat that they would shoot me. The relative I turned up, and their advice was to wear this bulletproof vest. Not that they were convinced it was going to happen. How could you ever know or not know something like that? And I remember my senior political advisor and close friend Graham Morris said, "Boss, you better do this." And I said, "I'm not going to wear that thing. I don't feel unsafe." And he persisted. He came back to me the next day. He said, "You've got to wear it." I said, "Why?" He said, "I'll tell you why." He said, "If you do get shot," he said, "I've got to tell Jeanette, my wife, and I've got to explain to her why it is we allowed you to appear without it." And I very reluctantly put it on, and I felt a fool afterwards having done so, because I never really felt unsafe in Australia. And although that was a very hostile rally, I didn't think anybody was going to try and shoot me. And after the rally was over, I went down and talked to a lot of people in the crowd. Some of them were polite, others weren't so polite, but that's part and parcel of public life in Australia.
Do you believe Australian governments have lost the ability to do difficult things?
Oh, no, I have not. I don't. I mean, I think I am specifically critical of this government for its failure to act about anti-Semitism after the terrible events of October 2023. But I'm not going to say generally speaking governments don't do difficult things. It's easy when you're out of it to say that. And I don't want to say it was difficult, the decision we took. But the truth is that people felt, some of our own supporters felt sort of left out, felt we'd sort of overreached. And we hadn't overreached. It was the right thing to do. And all the evidence that's emerged since is that they were very effective changes. And I often think to myself, if we hadn't taken automatic, semi-automatic weapons out of the system, the death toll in that terrible event before Christmas at Bondi might have been much worse.
In the wake of the Bondi terror attack, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese sought agreement on tightening regulations and a new national gun buyback scheme. Was he right to do that, do you think?
Well, not if he saw that as a diversion from his responsibility to lead an effective campaign against anti-Semitism. Now, if there are loopholes in the law, I'm in favour of closing, but that wasn't the main issue. The main issue that produced Bondi and was ultimately addressed with the establishment of the Royal Commission was, of course, anti-Semitism.
Not all states have signed on to the buyback scheme. Is that lack of consensus disappointing in the wake of such a tragedy?
Well, as I say, that's not the main issue. I mean, anything that will tighten the laws on a uniform basis are to be done. I mean, it should be done. But and clearly, if you can't get consensus, and the consensus that is sought is reasonable, that is disappointing. But I don't think that's the main issue, and I think it would be a mistake to allow that to become the main issue. It's important, but it's not the main issue.
And that is the former Prime Minister, John Howard, speaking with Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast, reflecting on the 30th anniversary of the Port Arthur massacre. You can listen to more coverage of the anniversary on ABC Listen. Well, the breaking news right at the start of this morning's show was that a man had been charged with attempting to assassinate US President Donald Trump when he allegedly attempted to storm the White House Correspondents' Dinner armed with knives and guns. Cole Thomas Allen, the 31-year-old suspect in this shooting, has been charged with two other federal firearms offences. He could face life in prison. Now, there's a lot of information going around about the attack and the hours leading up to it. Someone who would have once looked into an attack like this is Javed Ali. He's a former FBI analyst who's held senior positions on the National Intelligence Council and also the National Security Council under the Trump administration. He joined Sally, and here's what she asked him first.
How would you describe the heightened security challenges for the Secret Service and other organizations in keeping President Trump and his administration safe?
Well, now we have the third attempted attack against President Trump, or at least one that went off with the Thomas Crook shooting, and then the two other attempted attacks. And this is just a persistent and enduring challenge, unfortunately, in our country. But it is unusual to see three attempts against President Trump in not even 2 years.
What does that mean for those who are trying to protect him?
Well, this is an incredibly difficult challenge to protect any president of the United States, but certainly in the era we're in now, where presidents like to be out in public as much as they can and not just stay inside the much safer environment of the White House itself. And what the event over the weekend showed is that perhaps the Secret Service may need to rethink hosting or having these types of events in a hotel, because there's only so much the Secret Service can do to protect the room, protect the people in the room. But most of that hotel complex was not under the protection of the Secret Service, and it was open for business as well. And that's how the assailant managed to book a room and bring his weapons in with him. And there was no screening for that.
How close was this to have an alleged gunman charging a security point like this? Every second counted by the looks of the video we've seen.
Well, what we now know is that the person rented the room, assembled the attack plan in the room. I don't know what room he was on, but then he took an elevator, walked down to the floor above the ballroom where the White House Correspondents' Dinner was occurring, and he must have done some level of reconnaissance or planning to even get to that point, and then just sprinted through the first Secret Service checkpoint that he saw, and that's where he was then fired upon and wounded and stopped. So luckily he wasn't able to get into the ballroom itself, but in that chaotic few seconds where the shots were fired and was happening above the ballroom, that's when we've all seen the video of the plainclothes Secret Service agents in their tuxedos surrounding President Trump. And then within a few seconds, a tactical team that was off stage moved onto the stage and assumed sort of a firing position, because at that point, nobody knew how many attackers were there. Was somebody close to the ballroom? And this is what that sort of complexity looks like. They only have seconds to make these decisions and to move the president or vice president out of harm's way. And that all happened fairly quickly.
The suspect has appeared in court, and we also know that the White House is going to review security after this incident. How easy is it to start getting an understanding of people who may wish to harm the president a long way out? I mean, online, not in person, long before they get anywhere near the president.
I don't want to say it's impossible, but it's pretty darn close to impossible, because in the United States, it is not illegal to be radicalized, and there is no omnipresent FBI or other domestic security sort of look at speech online or activity online unless there's a basis to do so. There, you know, some criminal or intelligence basis to do so. So how is the FBI and the Secret Service and other law enforcement agencies, how are they supposed to get much deeper upstream into what people are thinking when it's not illegal to have those thoughts, however unpleasant that may sound?
Javed Ali there, a former FBI analyst who's held senior positions in the Trump administration. Well, the stage is set for one of the biggest tech trials of the decade, with two of the industry's most powerful names airing their bitter rivalry in court. Billionaire Elon Musk has brought a suit against OpenAI CEO Sam Altman and his company, alleging that it strayed from its founding non-profit mission, which was funded by Mr. Musk. But Sam Altman has then accused Elon Musk, who left OpenAI in 2018, of seeking to cripple the company as he tries to build up his own competing platform. Some of the biggest names in Silicon Valley could appear at this trial. It's a pivotal moment for the booming AI industry. Now, if you follow this sector at all, you may have read our next guest's writing. He is Paresh Dave, a senior writer at US-based tech publication Wired, and he came on with Sally this morning.
How significant is this trial?
It's significant. I mean, it could define the future of OpenAI. OpenAI continues to operate with this unique structure where there's a nonprofit in control of a for-profit venture. But the company has clearly been tilting towards for profit and, you know, selling to businesses. And Elon Musk really wants to push this company back towards its nonprofit roots, publishing open research and not pursuing commercial relationships as much as it has the past few years.
So what are the key claims that Mr. Musk is bringing forward in this lawsuit?
So Musk claims that he was involved in co-founding OpenAI, and that there was an agreement between him and Sam Altman and Greg Brockman, fellow co-founders, to pursue OpenAI as a nonprofit. And Musk claims that that contract, that sort of, you know, trust between them, was broken, and that as a result of Altman and Brockman pursuing a for-profit tilt, they have unjustly enriched themselves, and that Microsoft, which is one of OpenAI's biggest backers and one of its key early backers, aided and abetted this sort of breach by Altman and Brockman.
Just how big is OpenAI now? What do we know about its scale?
OpenAI is huge. I mean, 900 million users of ChatGPT on a regular basis. You know, perhaps the most valuable startup around. We'll see how it nets out with the SpaceX IPO happening pretty soon. It is trying to go public potentially later this year. While Anthropic, which is another AI company, has caught up to it in many ways, you know, OpenAI is still synonymous with AI as we've come to understand it the past couple of years.
Why has Elon Musk decided to take this legal action now? What was the catalyst here, do you think?
Oh, well, he filed this lawsuit a couple of years ago. And the thinking was at the time, you know, ChatGPT had come out, it was taking off, and Musk realized that he needed to get into the AI game. And so he ended up creating this XAI venture. And the, you know, maybe less charitable view of Musk bringing this lawsuit is that he brought this lawsuit to slow down OpenAI, kind of hamper them and distract them, so he would have a chance to catch up to OpenAI with his venture, XAI, and sort of try to like drag them down so XAI could grow and thrive and have a little bit more runway to get there. But irrespective of that, the people who side with Musk, at least in the context of this lawsuit, say that there is something important here about how nonprofits here in the U.S. are managed and controlled, and, you know, can nonprofits sort of change their face over time and become for-profits? That's potentially concerning. And they believe Musk is bringing a valid lawsuit as a result, even if he may have some ulterior motives.
Is there a personal element to this feud between Mr. Musk and Mr. Altman?
Certainly. Both of them have become sworn enemies increasingly over time. Altman has said that he believes that Musk is just doing this to prop up his own company and is misrepresenting their discussions over the years. Even just today, Musk called Sam Altman scam Altman. He's called OpenAI more like closed maximizing profit OpenAI. They are, you know, clear enemies here after having been pretty close when this was founded about a decade ago.
Paresh Dave, a senior writer at US-based technology publication Wired, ending today's episode of The Breakfast Wrap. Well, thank you so much for listening to all those interviews. They were presented by Sally Sara and produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. Josie Sargent produced today's episode of The Breakfast Wrap. And you can hear more interviews like those live every single morning at 6 o'clock on Radio National and ABC Listen. And then later on in the morning on Radio National, you can catch The Breakfast Wrap. But we can be in your ears whenever you want us on ABC Listen. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. See you tomorrow.